We continue our deliberations with a discussion of rate-regulated activities. I give the floor to Jane.
Sorry, Mariella.
Oh, Mariella, sorry.
Good morning, everyone. We have prepared three papers for today's meeting. The first of these papers is the agenda paper. This paper provides background information about the model we are developing for defining regulation, and it also contains a summary of the board's tentative positions today. We don't intend to go through this paper unless you have any questions. Starting then maybe with agenda paper 9B. This paper deals with the scope of the model, and what we are trying to do in this paper is identifying clear and objective criteria that are both necessary and sufficient for the origination of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. We start analysis with the description of the fund for regulation that we have been using recently in this project, and that description is in paragraph 8 of the paper. And our analysis in paragraph 9 to 22 concludes that three of the four features of the fund's regulation in that paragraph, the binding terms of a regulatory agreement together with a basis for setting the rate that includes a mechanism that creates time indifference, should be part of the features that are the criteria that establish the scope of the model. In paragraph 23 to 32, we provide details and reasons why we don't think we need to include the fourth feature in paragraph 8, which is the limitation on entry and on exit, and as well as other features that we included previously in the definition of defined regulation that we had in the DP in 2014, because we don't think those are necessary for the origination of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. We think instead those features affect the design of the rate formula and contribute to the effectiveness in achieving the objectives of rate regulation, but per se do not originate regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. So, for example, in the case of regulatory assets, a limitation on entry increases the probability of benefits flowing to the entity, but per se, they do not. This feature does not contribute to the existence of the right. It might affect the measurement of the right. So our question for the board is whether it agrees with the staff recommendation in paragraph 33 of the paper and the features of the final regulation that we have concluded are both necessary and sufficient, and therefore then should be included in the definition of the scope of the model.
Mary?
I'm going to start off the discussion with a bit of a challenge for the staff on this one. While largely in agreement with the analysis, including the specific analysis about deleting the specific proposal for controls on exit or entry to the marketplace, I do not agree that we don't need anything. We don't need anything more on as a variant of exit and entry. So, and I'm not sure if what I'm expressing is a condition of my conclusion at the last month when we analyzed the definition of asset and liability against the conceptual framework, or whether it's more with respect to recognition. And sometimes it's difficult to distinguish what your criteria are for the existence of an asset or the recognition of an existing asset. And, cut to the chase, I think that we need to continue to express as a necessary condition for the model the fact that the regulator via the binding regulatory agreement has the intention of supporting the financial viability of the regulated entity. That was an important feature of the characteristic that we talked about last month. It's, I think, repeated on the overview slide that we capture in 9A. And if, as the staff analyzes, suggests in its analysis, it's a redundant, staff said it's judgmental and it's redundant. I'm not troubled by it being judgmental. And to me, as a characteristic, what separates the right of a, let's say, a utility, an electricity provider that is defined rate regulation, why their right to raise prices is a recognized asset. And notice I'm avoiding the issue of is it recognition or definition by calling it recognized asset. And while the company that manufactures this phone, that even if it operates in what the staff refers to as a general price regulation setting, it has a right to raise, its prices, but why we do not recognize that right to raise the price of this phone as an asset. So if it's a redundant characteristic, it does no harm, because if it's always present for an entity that is within defined rate regulation, I think we should include it in whatever I'm trying to be neutral about what our next document is, whether our next document is DP or ED. But I think including it as a necessary characteristic, and if it's redundant, it shouldn't cause any problems, because anybody who would otherwise qualify will also have it. And I cannot imagine it sweeping somebody in who we don't intend to be there. And if somebody thinks they should be in there, and they're not only because they don't have that commitment, from the regulator to support its, for the agreement to support financial viability, I want to hear what those situations are, where I'm being excluded, I should be in, and I'm being excluded because you've required this commitment to support financial viability. So my bottom line is agree with all the analysis except, including the we do not need the characteristic of limit of entry and exit to the marketplace, but disagree that we do not have to replace entry or exit to the marketplace with a characteristic of the binding regulatory agreement being a commitment by the regulator to support the financial viability of the entity. And that's my concern with the analysis in the paper. And I refuse to be pinned down, at least at a public board discussion, about whether that's an asset definition issue or whether that's a recognition criterion. But I think in terms of getting to a recognized asset, and the same comments would apply on the flip side to liability.
Sorry, but you're talking about scope now, right?
Well, right, but it translates to scope, because if you say you don't need a requirement for the regulator being committed under the terms of the agreement to supporting the financial viability of the entity, it would not be a scope criterion, and I am concerned that somebody could then be within the scope of this and to me not satisfy the analysis that we did last month about meeting the definition of the asset. So that's why I think when the staff goes through in paper 9B, what the scope criteria are, should be that in striking out entry and exit controls and not coming up with a substitute, and I think they're right to strike out entry and exit, I think not coming up with a substitute is where I am struggling. And that's where I want to put financial viability support as the replacement attribute. It's softer. Right. Right. It's softer. It is judgmental. I haven't been able to identify the harm it does, and it certainly helps me in distinguishing the right to raise the price of this versus the right to raise the price of electricity, translating into a recognized asset on my balance sheet.
I had just a question really on the proposed criteria and the use of the word binding. So, because I'm not sure we've used that word before that I can remember anyway in other standards, and I just wondered, it made me stop and think about what it is that we're trying to capture there. Do we mean enforceable, mm-hmm. or do we mean something more? And sort of in the reverse, to be binding, does it have to be enforceable? And the reason why I'm interested in that is that if you look at IFRS 15 and IFRS 17, used in a different context, it's not used to define scope, but the contracts that you analyse to apply revenue recognition and the insurance contract standard require you to look at the contract being an enforceable agreement, and we've got quite developed criteria about the enforceable means, including the relevance of legal precedent and things like that when looking at what contractual terms to consider. If we just mean enforceable, if that's all that we're trying to say, and I'm not sure, I think it would be good to use the same word we've used elsewhere if we mean the same thing, because otherwise when I look at the word binding, I think, oh, well, we must mean something different because otherwise we would have used the same word. So do we mean something more, or is it enforceable plus, or is it just another word for enforceable?
I think it is intended to be enforceable. I mean, we've looked on some of the legal guidance, and it uses the two words not quite interchangeably, but for something to be binding, it must be enforceable. To be enforceable, it must be binding. So we'll take a look at IFRS 15 and any other place we've used.
The only difference I wondered if you meant was, I assumed that to be binding, it needed to be enforceable. I did wonder whether we meant something subtly in addition, which was sort of, you have to be part of this regime to be in this industry, almost, sort of indirectly. Maybe you don't mean that, but it's binding because the regulatory framework basically says you have to be part of this. And is that sort of enforceable plus? I think it would be good to think about what we think the difference or similarity is between those words, because otherwise people are going to read more or less into it than we may or may not intend.
Yeah.
Nick?
Thank you. I guess I have some concerns what Mary's suggesting in terms of putting financial variability into the criteria. So if it's redundant, it does no harm, but does it do any good also, I would ask. And I guess perhaps it's an area where staff would do some further research rather than put that commitment in today. So I do wonder whether that commitment is explicit in all circumstances, and also situations where regulated entities are part of larger groups also would be a consideration I'd like to think about. So today I'm not comfortable committing to making that addition.
I also wonder if this is truly the frame of mind of most of these regulators, that they are there to maintain the financial viability of a company. I think they are there to maintain provision of energy to the customers. And the byproduct may be this viability thing, but I think it will not be understood this.
I think Nick's right, that from what we've seen, sometimes it's reasonably explicit, but in other times it's more expressed in terms, as Han said, it's the continuation of the service rather than the continuation of the entity, but the two go hand in hand. But again, it's that lack of clarity of an objective criterion. It is judgmental, and I, as you say, I don't think it is necessary. I think we're going to find it there, but to me, it's not clearly expressed enough to be a criterion that we would have to have. And again, it goes to the effectiveness of the regulation rather than the legal rights created by the agreement.
If you would want to do something, I wouldn't see the harm. I understand the problems with exit and entry criteria, but I don't see the harm in saying something more general, like this has to happen in a highly monopolistic market, because that's always the case.
Well,
there may be some other entrance, but the nature of the market is that it is dominated by a near monopoly. I mean, otherwise, I don't think the model has, in other circumstances, the model has no viability.
But I think, Hans, that's exactly the series of characteristics that we've chased around in both the request for information and the discussion paper. Is typically it's monopolistic or near monopolistic. Typically, the agreement has some conditions about entry and exit. And I think one of the things we heard is that we really confuse people if we have a continuum of things that at some not discernible point cross over from indicators to criteria. and people said, tell me what it is that you need to have to be in, and don't clutter it with indicators or suggestions or characterizations, because then it's not clear if I need to meet a majority of those or, you know, have some assessment of them. And the reason that, I mean, I take your point about conglomerates, and I think in a conglomerate I would expect it to be within the, you know, within the piece of the entity that is subject to, you know, to the rate regulation rather than being committed to the whole of the group. But I think if we take out limits on entry and exit, which I think we should. I'm not complaining about that, but I think the combination of the removal of that and then not capturing, when you look at paper 9A on page 4, the excerpt from the slide, the basis for setting rates, one of the things we identify in that slide is the financial viability, you know, supporting the financial viability is one of the characteristics of the rate setting regime. And then to not pick that up in the scope seems to me a disconnect between the context in which we analyzed assets and liabilities. And so, you know, Nick, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you said about redundant and why build in redundancy if you don't need it. But to me, it was such an important part of the context for our assessment of assets and liabilities. I hate to just have it disappear. And Hans, I don't think we can kind of make ourselves feel a bit more comfortable by saying, well, here are the things that are typically present. Because while that may be useful context, I think we've got to be really clear about what the criteria are for entry and not muddle that with characteristics as well.
Gary?
Thank you. Jane, you know, I support the direction we're going on it, but Mary raised some questions I had too. In paragraph 26, you talked about the last consultative group meeting, and so presumably industry experts did not think barriers on entry and exit was a big deal. But the I could see a case being made, and if we did a DP, you'd make it in there, but I'm hoping we go to a DD, so I think we'd have to decide in advance, is whether it's financial commitment by the regulator to support financial viability, or it's practically speaking, there aren't going to be any new entrants and exits in it. You know, when I look at, and you know, they're out of scope of this project, but if you think of the London cab scene, I mean, those are regulated rates. They presumably are rates that allow the individual black cab driver to make a living, even though there's no commitment to that, and there's a presumption as you work enough hours and things. But it's not hard to have entrants, whether it's in the minicabs, Uber, private hire cars that are essentially very direct competitors in different ways, and not to mention other alternatives, you know, like the two. So it strikes me as, and I agree with the mandatory criteria that are laid out in paragraph 33. The question is either should there be more, the commitment to financial viability, practical barriers to entrance or exit, or similar. Now, whether it's in the definition or it's supporting conditions that, if not present, challenge recoverability of the asset, but it does feel to me we should do something. And I don't know that I'd lay on the tracks if we didn't, but it has that feel. You know, could you talk about the consultative group meeting and why they didn't think some of that was necessary?
Again, I think we've tried to capture it in the paper in that they were keen on having criteria that are objective and, as we said, both necessary and sufficient. So the more criteria you have in there that are not essential, that are not necessary, the harder it is then to work through whether you're in or out, and particularly these where there is going to be some element of judgment. So if we say there's a limitation on entry, how big does that limitation need to be? Where's the crossover point? If there's support for the financial viability, how explicit does that need to be? Mm-hmm. How much support does it need? So the more these criteria become subjective, the harder it is to actually operationalize what we're trying to do here.
Okay. Because I changed my reading through, and I said, okay, they get a good point. There's overflow and, you know, peak things, you know, Meyer, you know, suppliers? Are they in the market? Are they just part of the supply chain? I was getting that, but then Mr. Mary's, but you know, I always felt that was an important criteria. I said, okay, they're the experts, a good deal, but there is an implied financial protection of by the regulators. So if it's not in the criteria, then I think we probably might need some supporting conditions that lend its presence, lends support of, and its absence detracts from, you know, recoverability of assets or something. So just, again, just a reaction. I mean, I wouldn't lay in the traction, but just feels like we need that.
But Gary and Mary, isn't the difference between what the scope is that's proposed by the staff and the taxis and Uber and all of that thing, the existence of the rate adjustment mechanism?
Yeah. Then maybe it is.
That's not enough for you. Because I think that's what we're being asked to look at as being the difference.
And to be honest,
an enforceable right to these true-up adjustments that set out in the framework.
Well, if we could make the case, I think, that the rate adjustment mechanism is the artifice, you know, that the rate regulator uses to deliver financial viability, well, then maybe we're there. You know, I mean, you're just given a reaction chain there, as opposed to, you know,
a barrel.
So I'm comfortable with where the staff have landed on this. A couple of pointers out of the conversation has come up so far. I think the example that is in 26E doesn't necessarily spell it out entirely, but that example coming out of the working group discussion was the one that made me realize that monopolistic is not necessarily a driver, because in that circumstance, the core provider of electricity in that market has a fundamental price advantage over everybody else. The market was completely open, so anybody can enter and exit the market as they like. But what the regulator was seeking to do was, on one hand, price the ability of this big provider to either gorge the market and take as much as possible out, but at the same time, to Mary's point, protect the viability of this big provider so that they continue to survive. I think the problem I have with the term viability is it becomes one of degree. So the first instance, and you touched on it a little bit when you were talking about the exit entrance thing, how much exit, how much entrance, how much support for viability. And I think we heard a lot of examples in the working group about, for example, the regulator undertaking to set the rate adjustment mechanism for costs prudently expended. Now, what happens if costs are not prudently expended? Well, the regulator is not prepared to. That's a matter of judgment. But presumably, if that impacts on viability, the regulator is not simply going to be paying out. So does that imply that that entity would fail the test, even though? The other thing is, I think while it is inherent in a lot of these, or implicit in a lot of these agreements that it's there, I don't know that it's always going to be an explicit thing. And I think the problem that I'd identified in there is I thought it was, to pick up on next term, I thought it was redundant. I didn't think it was necessary because I thought what we were focusing on was the rate adjustment mechanism. But my real concern about this one was, what do I do if it's implicit? What do I do if I have those prudently expended type of things in? And particularly in circumstances where there may be three or four providers, so the regulator can allow one who is not prudent in the expenditure to fail. So I think I was relatively comfortable with where you got to on this.
Thank you. Well, I'm also supportive of the conclusion that the staff has reached, and largely for the reason that she was just expressed, that in fact the assets and liabilities arise through the rate setting mechanism in the way it is described in the proposed scope, and having additionally, the fact that it has to be enforceable so that you don't have any political game around not applying the adjustments that have been required. And this fits in the view I've had for a long time, that these price setting mechanisms make the price that is paid by the customer from an entity perspective, transitory until the rate-setting mechanism determines the final price of that particular performance obligation that has been delivery that has been provided. I would agree that you are likely to find rate regulation when the public authority think that there is not enough competition to protect the customers. So yes, it's likely that we are going to find out that this takes place in this kind of environment. But I agree that it's not a necessary criterion. And I would not support bringing redundant criteria, even more so when they would be judgmental, because, first of all, I think it adds to the complexity in the implementation. And I think it's also a very high risk of hindrance to comparability, because, you know, it's going to be, as Jane has expressed, in some agreements it's going to be explicitly specified, in others it will be implicit, and then you have all sorts of forces in the implementation time that we try to interpret. And that is not going to be done in full convergence. So I think there is a lot of good reasons for avoiding redundant criteria when it is eventually possible to have identified just those who are necessary and sufficient.
Jin Zhao.
Thank you, yes. I generally agree with the staff's improvement to the scope. And I also think the scope is really important, and try to make the scope as clear as possible and as strict as possible is important. I have several recommendations. First, with regard to the paragraph 33A, I agree with Sue's point. I think enforceability is the key to identify the scope. So binding, simply use the word binding is not enough. So my recommendation is to add one sentence in the end of this, in the end of paragraph 33A, such as the formal regulatory framework that is binding on both the entity and the rate regulator. And the binding terms establish the enforceable rights and obligation for the entity. I think once we add this paragraph, this sentence, I think it's quite clear, more than clear than simply using the word in the binding. And maybe we also address the issue, part of the issue. Mary and Gary said that there are some commitments, something like that. But the result is that rights and obligation should be enforceable. And secondly, B, I have several suggestions. I think the B is very important because it's relevant to rate adjustment mechanism. First, we said that the framework should establish a basis for setting the rate, but it's not clear for what the rate setting. Well, I think sometimes companies provide a lot of goods and services. Some good services are rate regulated, some are not. So I suggest that to add one term behind the rate to establish a basis for setting the rate for specified goods or services to make it clear. Yeah, it's, and secondly, because we introduced the notion of the timing differences, I agree. But sometimes the regulator, you establish this kind of rate adjustment mechanism. Sometimes they adjust the rate, but the rate also relevant to the time period. Suppose you charge more in one period, eventually you will less charge it because the rate will adjust. But how long it will be less charged? I think the framework should identify it. Otherwise, they will take in, you know, whole life of the entity. Especially if there is a loss happened, and these are regulated assets recognized, how long it will be recovered. So I think whether it's possible to specify that there are
specific time periods.
Yes, specify or provide some constraint of the time period. Otherwise, it's open a room for the entity to manage those performance or something like that. I think the framework should be set to specify this kind of thing, not simply just to make judgments, make adjustments for the rate. Certainly, we mentioned that the regulate in one period includes amounts related to specified activities. I understand, you know, sometimes you built a property and you can recover those costs by increasing future rates. So these kind of activities. Sometimes you got lost because of lab, blood, flood, or something like that. But eventually, those effects will go to the price of the goods and services. So I think I would suggest that do not mention or relate to those specified activities, because those impact eventually will impact the price of or the rate of the goods and services you delivered. Whatever, regardless what kind of activities you're undertaking or your impact. So I would like to change the word. I suggest the regulated rate in one period includes amount that related to those specified goods or services the entity delivered. I think eventually we are make adjustments for those price or those rate or those specified goods and services, not for those specified activities. Yes. The focus should focus on those goods and services, the rates, not focus on those activities, regardless of what kind of activities. So it could make those things more clearly. Yeah. So this is my comment.
Jenny, you want to react? Mariella?
We agree with the comment.
Yeah, we agree with the comment. Okay. That more specific. Yeah.
Tom.
I'm supportive of where the staff's going. I just have a concern that 8B, where it gets elaborated on in paragraphs 15 through 17, I don't think you're as precise and compelling as you could be. You seem to talk a lot about, you know, price caps and why they're not rate regulated. And I think my advice would be to put the thing into the affirmative. And so I think in particular the first sentence in paragraph 16, which I don't like, says the existence of a basis for setting the rate. I think that phrase should only be used in the sense of rate regulated. And then it says affects only the rate per unit. I think you should be really clear that the basis for rate regulation should not be confused with a price cap. I think it should be written up much more that way, as opposed to you have a basis and it could be either a price cap or a rate regulated. I just think that's a dangerous path. And if you went to the affirmative, I think it'd be really good to start saying what, rather than what it isn't, to say what it is. Like, what are the characteristics that are important for a basis for rate regulation? And we've listed a lot, and actually eight actually puts in some. It talks about specified goods and services. It talks about minimum quality levels. I'd even prefer specific levels of quality. I think minimum is doesn't really capture rate regulation well. But some of the other characteristics I think that are important is that, my understanding, typically rate regulation effectively specifies both a maximum and a minimum, often in the same number. It's not just a cap. Secondly, as you point out, it typically talks about quality and specified levels of quality. And this probably goes into quite a bit of detail, which is why I don't like the term minimum. And then, as was raised earlier, the ultimate goal is sustainability of the service or the good. And so I think that goes into the basis as well. And I think in practice, a lot of times, a corollary to that is that the rate will often refer to necessary levels of investment and necessary costs or legitimate costs. But I think you could write this up much more in the affirmative. And I would just put the price cap as, I would be much happier if you just said, price cap is kind of a different world. That's not what we're talking about.
Could I ask Tom a question about what he was... It just is a question. Tom, you're talking about the drafting in paragraph 8, but if you look at paragraph 33, I think the staff is talking about deleting a lot of the characteristics you were discussing from the scope criteria. So were you saying you think they should be back in?
Sorry, which one?
If you look at paragraph 33... Mm. You were talking about the wording of paragraph 8.
Well, mostly I was concerned with the wording of paragraphs, so what is it, 16 to 19?
Right. But the things that you were just discussing, if you look at paragraph 33, you see the staff is proposing deleting those things.
So that's fine, but that I'm still okay with that. If I'm assuming there's going to be, if paragraph 8 then is split into three sections in this document, right? So paragraph 8 introduces it, and then paragraphs, you go on to the binding, see, that's in paragraphs 9 to 14. Basis is in paragraphs 15 to 17 or 18. Rate adjustment regular is in the next set of paragraphs. And so I'm assuming when they do that, there's still going to be some background paragraphs, and it's not going to be a purely standalone. And I'm much more concerned with the background paragraphs to the basis, which is what my comments were on. I just cited 8 as the starting point. But that's a question then for the staff, is in those changes, I think probably I'm going to redirect your question, is in the changes, are there still a whole pile of background paragraphs that are going to elaborate?
I think there would need to be to explain how the timing differences can actually be identified, because without the reference to the specified goods and services, the specified service levels, etc., it would be hard to identify the timing difference, because what we're talking about is that clear link between what the rate relates to.
So my comments were mostly about the background paragraphs, but I think it's a good point. The thing should be a nice package from the nice summary. Here are the three big things in the background paragraphs. I still would like to see them written in the affirmative as opposed to what they aren't.
Amaro.
Thanks, Senator. So, comment quickly on tones. I think the way I heard Tom is suggesting to be more, to beef up a little bit the basis for our conclusion. It's not really to bring this back, and that I agree. On general, I'm in agreement with the direction of the project. On a few things, on the enforceable, on 33A, to me, it's fine. It's captured what we wanted. When I read binding and enforceable, and my mind translate to Portuguese means absolutely the same. What is binding is enforceable. What is enforceable is binding. So I'm fine. I think it's wise for us if we do use the term in other piece of our literature to be consistent in that. It's a very good suggestion. As for Mary, necessary conditions supporting the necessary viability, I'm really supportive of how the staff is proposing the scope here, and although, well, the redundancy, since it's redundant, then comes it does harm or does not harm, and I think I'm in the camp that it do harm the project. Because although in my jurisdiction, most contracts, at least the ones I do know, do have some aspect of viability, It's much more into the camp of, I think, what Sue mentioned, in the rate setting adjustment mechanism. They have to take into consideration the viability, but it's not really, as you mentioned, per se, generate or originate any right or obligation. So I would prefer not having this back. And last comment on Jintao suggestions. I'm concerned about his last suggestion on C, and in crossing out his specified activities and changing for goods and services delivered. I think specified activities capture more what the model is meant to capture, because when you build a dam, you are not really yet delivering goods or services, but you are performing activities that was required by the regulator eventually, and those activities are going to be included or considered in the rate setting mechanism. And in the same instance, it will capture the goods and services delivered in the previous sales. So I would actually think we need to keep activities.
Thank you. I have a slight hesitation to removing no effective competition condition. So we are discussing entrance and exit, and we are discussing financial viability. But in the essence, I think no effective competition environment is the key of this model. In order to make the mechanism work effectively, if there is effective competition, then sometimes mechanism wouldn't work. I think, of course, the other condition, if we put no effective competition, that makes the system work difficult. So therefore, I need to put some element into the binding criteria. I think Jin Chao pointed out a very important point. For example, recently, I see some service provider which they are calling themselves as a last one mile business. So they was last one mile business. So they are providing electricity as well as internet and home security services and everything together as a package. And then retailing electricity supply is rate regulated. Then they will follow the pricing mechanism. However, they can provide some discount for other services because it's a package of the services. So therefore, the essence is whether or not the rate regulation is working effectively or not. And in order to measure the rate regulation mechanism is working effectively is whether or not there is effective competition or not. In the case I raised is the case they are providing total package of services. So supplying electricity is part of the services. So there are other competitors. So including other services, they can make a discount or they have a competition. Eventually, even if there is the rate regulation, that is not substantially working. So there might be such a situation.
Well, then there will be no assets or liabilities.
Yeah, that's the point. Well, that's the point. But if there is no asset and the liability, then you cannot recognize a regulatory asset or liability. But if you're just focusing on the electricity services, and if you say there is a binding, as far as electric supply is concerned, and there is some mechanism of charging more, it's true, but if you are providing other services together and compete with other competitor, including with other services, substantially, it's not really working.
But so, I think you're getting into the next paper.
Because
it's not likely, not more likely than not, then you
yes.
cannot recognize it.
Yes. Yes, it's going to next paper. But my point is, in order to make the, you know, binding mechanism clearer, I think we need, you know, something more on the binding element, as somebody else is pointing out. Just the binding is simply enforceable. It has not different from the IFRS 15's condition for everybody else's condition. But binding should add something more on the binding condition. If we were to delete all these conditions of 4.4, that is the point.
Peter, you want to get in?
I think TAC raised two different points there. Actually, I think one was a general point about binding, but there was also a specific point about the packaging with non-regulated services. And that reminds me, actually, of a discussion we had with the ASAF probably two or three meetings back. To my mind, the reason why it's worth accounting for these incremental assets and liabilities separately is because they're cleanly separable from the other things. And I think TAC's example of the packaged services might be case whether it's questionable whether it's cleanly separable. And by cleanly separable, I think it's not just that the incremental asset, that the incremental rider obligation, you can measure that separately, but it's also, does it have any effect on what's left once you've pulled that piece out? And in your case, where there's a discount that, you know, there's a question of sort of allocation across the two components, that may be questionable, and that might be something we need to look at. But I think that's a specific example.
Daryl?
I was struggling a little bit with the example, because I was thinking that in those last mile type of entities, the rate regulation typically kicks in the supplier to the last mile person. So it's about the rate at which you, and if there's that final provider, I'm not sure, particularly if the provider's providing mixed product, I'm not sure they're subject to the same rate regulation. What is regulated essentially is the price at which they buy the services. Yeah. But I think, given what Peter said, I'm not sure that's relevant actually to anything. So that's me musing aloud.
Yeah, just on that point, so if we simply focus on the supplier to the B2B business, then it's fine. It's totally fine. But whether or not, the question is, are we going to, you know, apply to the B2C businesses? So then, in that case, scope is quite difficult.
Well, I don't think we necessarily we're focusing on either of those specifically. We're focusing on those where the regulator is impacting or is determining the price that's finally charged.
Yeah.
And in the example you talk, and I think there are plenty of circumstances where that occurs in a B2C type situation. Yeah. But the example you gave seemed to be a B2B situation, not.
I think we might be absolutely.
Yeah.
So I guess the staff has received some suggestions as to the specific wording of the recommendations. But I would like to see who can support the recommendation for the staff for the scoping of this rate regulation.
Subject to how we define binding.
13.
Okay.
Agenda paper 9C. This paper discusses the recognition of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that arise from the rate adjustment mechanism in the regulatory agreement. The paper first provides an overview of the recognition criteria in the forthcoming conceptual framework. These are in paragraph 5-8 of the paper. The conceptual framework states that an asset or liability is recognized if its recognition provides information that is useful in the sense of relevant information and faithful representation of the asset or liability. And information might not be relevant if it's uncertain the asset or liability exists, and even if it does exist, there is a low probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits. And the level of measurement uncertainty associated with the asset or liability affects whether the recognition of the asset or liability provides faithful representation. Having in consideration then this framework, then we start analyzing the different items, and starting with existence uncertainty, this is covered in paragraph 15 to 23 of the paper. What we have noted is that for most timing differences, there will be little or no existence uncertainty. And this is because these timing differences either related to items that have been confirmed by a formal approval, or they relate to automatic rate adjustments or pass-through adjustments that, even though might not have been included in the regulatory returns yet, they are contemplated explicitly in the regulatory agreement. In a few cases, the assessment of existence uncertainty will require some judgment, and this is when the timing differences are not mentioned explicitly in the regulatory agreements. In some cases, there might be timing differences related to unanticipated events, such as a major storm, and then it would be in those cases when an entity will need to interpret the regulatory agreement and consider a hierarchy of factors to assess the probability that those timing differences will end up being captured finally in the rate adjustment mechanism. So when a regulatory asset or regulatory liability exists, then we think typically there will be a high probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits occurring, and there will be little measurement uncertainty. And this is because it will be rare that the demand risk will be so severe that no flows at all will occur, or that we will end up with unreasonable measurement estimates. So the question for the board is whether it agrees with our recommendation in paragraph 35 of the paper, which is to require a symmetric recognition threshold of more likely than not in cases of existence uncertainty, and to not include the specific requirements for entities to assess whether to recognize regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities when the probability of inflow or outflows is low, or in conditions of high measurement uncertainty.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with the staff's recommendations, and sort of strikes me as there's really nothing new under the sun. I mean, you know, hurricanes occur, bad weather occurs, and these, you know, regulated enterprises, general utilities, have been around a long time, and you sort of understand, everyone sort of understands the formal and informal rules of the game. So, I think we need to address it. I think more likely than not, it's about is the right threshold. And I think for stuff that's not in formal rate orders, there's typically enough precedence either with yourself or within the industry at the same rate regulator. So I'm very comfortable with your recommendations.
Françoise.
Thank you. I agree with the staff recommendation. I would just want to raise a little flag for probably the next discussions to come when we come to measurement. And it's in reference to what you say in paragraph 30, related to the cost of providing the information. I agree with what you say in that paragraph, so that you suggest that the data are available because they are needed in the way the rate agreement, rate regulation agreement functions. But I think to come to that conclusion when we move along, we need to ensure that in how we set the measurement of those things, we do not create different sets of data, because otherwise it would no longer be verified. So it's not a flag in relation to the recommendation today that I fully support, but it's helping you in your future developments.
Doug?
Thank you. Let me just talk about impairment of the asset. This model highly depends on the existence of the asset, existence certain uncertainty or uncertainty, and they introduce the threshold of more likely than not. It's fine. And I think it's a good idea. However, say think about the situation like environment indicate that it is no longer more likely than not the asset exists. So in that case, would entity has to, write off the entire asset? Just asking a question. So entire asset. If impairment applies, it's not the matter of degree of the, measurement. So it's not not the issue of the measurement, but it's the issue of existence or not existence. So That worries me a little bit, because if we depend on the existence threshold, which is more likely than not, mm-hmm. then the danger is that all of a sudden you need to write off total asset.
And isn't this a different question, though? Because this is about recognition.
Yeah.
I don't know that it necessarily implies that it's the identical test for derecognition.
I'm somehow peeking ahead. But once we decided, we have to consider the what comes next. So once we decided that this is a good idea, fantastic, but then all of a sudden, when we consider what the impairment is all about and derecognition is all about, then all of a sudden, so for 3 years it's fine, but in fourth years, hang on a second, judging from this environment, there are lots of competition, because we may delete the condition of the competition. Then because of the competition, all of a sudden, my asset may not exist. So then you have to recognize total impairment. And then 3 years' time after the impairment losses, then competition, the environment has improved. Hang on a second, I might have an asset. And it could be on or off situation. That is what I was wondering. It's a good idea to say that, whether or not exist or not exist, rather than, just measurement uncertainty. In order to avoid the measurement uncertainty, it's a good idea. However, my fear is about the recognition.
Sue?
I agree with the approach suggested, but one of the reasons why I asked the question about enforceability is I think there's a bit of a relationship between that question for scope and this, because let's use an extreme example. Let's say that you've got a sort of regulatory regime where it's pretty clear what the sort of, at least on paper, what the amount is that you're allowed to increase by in the future, but we know that in this particular jurisdiction in the past sometimes the court has overturned that because they've decided it's too harsh on customers or something, and I'm making this scenario up, but so let's say that you therefore concluded that you didn't actually have a binding. You might conclude you don't actually have a binding / enforceable regime in the first instance to even get into scope. So I presume that this is cases where you've concluded that actually the regime sort of does work, as it would suggest on paper, because the court's going to follow it. But this is more to do with, the specifics on, is this, the type of cost that was envisaged, all of that sort of stuff, right? So there's sort of two layers.
Yes, yeah.
I was wondering if it is indeed so enforceable, etc., why then such a low threshold? I mean, wouldn't in most cases it would be highly probable that it's going to happen?
Yeah.
So why so low?
I mean, it's a conceptual framework.
It's the conceptual framework, yeah.
Is that what?
Well, I mean, we need to think about this for assets and liabilities as well. So would you be comfortable with having a high threshold to recognise liabilities, and if not, would you then go into an asymmetric threshold where you would need a higher one for the asset than the liability? And I think you're right, Hans, that in the majority of cases that we see, it's fairly obvious whether it exists or not. So we're talking about a fairly small population of items where we need to have this interpretation. And in paragraph 21, we've put that hierarchy, which touches on what Gary said, that a lot of these, it may not be explicit in the agreement itself, but you could have precedents either from the company itself, from other companies. And it really is a balance, and I don't think, and picking up tax point as well, I think tax point is, I'm not saying it's not possible that would happen, but it's at such an extreme end of the scale that I think, it's something that, yes, we need to keep in mind, but I think we should be setting the model for the majority of cases rather than the extreme ends of a range.
Darryl?
So I'm relatively comfortable. I'm comfortable with where you've landed here. I think there are a couple of things that are going into this. I think the point about almost a valley in between. I think there's a high if something's likely, well, there's going to be a lot of stuff with a very high probability. There's going to be a number of stuff with a almost zero probability, and I suspect there's going to be very little in between. I think the other thing, and this comes a little bit to the derecognition point that Tuck raised, is because these types of relationships tend to have, as I understood it from the working group, tend to have a fairly ongoing dialogue between the regulator and the regulator. My impression was that the doubt about existence gets resolved relatively quickly. So anything that is in the sort of doubtful place is subject to a dialogue that happens on a fairly regular basis between the regulator and the entity being regulated. Where I think there's a different issue is the measurement uncertainty, because that's when you bring in things like demand certainty and all of those other types of measures. But I don't think those relate to existence. I think those relate to the way you measure the thing once you've determined it exists. I do think, and I haven't actually necessarily thought through entirely where I would land on the derecognition line item, but I think that would probably drive the thinking.
Mary?
Let me build on what Daryl said and suggest that we try and identify and kind of set aside for the next round of discussion, which is measurement, the issues associated with demand risk, because I think while Tuck raised an example of that he saw as you'd qualify, then you'd fail to meet the qualification criteria, and you know, so that at least if you were assessing it again at year two, you'd say I fail. When you said year one, I'd pass. I think that the reason you identified of because there's competition, that implies that you are exposed to demand risk. But to me, that's not about the existence of the right to raise the rate. It's about how much you're going to recover. Because I think one of the things we have to keep thinking about is when we talk about the right to raise the rate, we're talking about adjusting the P on the P times Q formula. And the regimes will vary about whether they'll also give you protection if the Q is not what you expect. So if you have demand risk, they'll give you the right to raise P.
Yeah.
But if Q varies from what the target is, that's your benefit or that's your loss. So I think that the statement in paragraph 28 of paper 9C may not be correct, that once you conclude that something exists, there's a high probability of inflows or outflows. Because when we did the initial request for information, we heard that a lot of systems were going to hybrid schemes that have some degree of demand risk. And you know, at least collars around, et cetera. So I think there can be some question about inflow of P times Q because of demand risk. But I don't think it raises questions about existence. So I support the staff analysis about what the benchmark should be. You know, and Hans, to your point, if this is the hurdle and most people clear it by a wide margin, or you know, most transactions, I don't think that's a reason to move the hurdle up so everybody just clears it. I think more likely than not is the right threshold with respect to existence. But I think we maybe have to think about toning down statements like the one in paragraph 28, because in an environment of hybrid schemes with at least some degree of demand risk put back on the utility, there may be some question, but if it's clear that the item exists, I think that's a measurement issue, not an existence issue. And you know, I did have some question when the staff said in the recommendation paragraph 35B that we do not need to include specific requirements if the probability is low or there's high measurement uncertainty. I think that's generally right in respect of the recognition criteria, but I think we shouldn't be in denial and simplify it all down so that it's always clear, because I think there are many times when I'm given, you know, when an entity is given a P rate increase, and that's the asset we're recognizing, we're talking about recognizing, but they're not given protection on the queue, and yet the asset that they recognize as a result is P times their estimate of Q. And they may not get all that. And I think that those are measurement issues. They're not about whether or not they have the right to increase or obligation to decrease P.
Yeah.
John, thank you. I agree with that. There was that recommendation. However, let me ask Peter, because this is related to conceptual framework. So in the paragraph 7A, as a recognition criteria, it is uncertain whether an asset or liability exists. So we are putting just a more likely than that kind of a phrase there. So is it putting that kind of more likely than not, is it consistent with this kind of conceptual framework here, A?
So the conceptual framework itself doesn't set any criteria for what to do in cases of existence uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason the board decided not to do that is existence uncertainty isn't the most common situation. It's a bit fact-specific. And so you felt it was best to deal with that at the standards level rather than try to come up with a consistent answer that would be applied in each case. So this can't really be inconsistent with the framework because the framework doesn't give any specific requirement in those cases.
Okay, so this is consistent application of the conceptual framework. But I could read that the kind of tendency of the new conceptual framework implies, because, you know, the ISO 37 contingent asset, there we are requiring to recognize a contingent asset as an asset, the existence must be virtually certain. But in this case, it's on a lower threshold than the virtually certain existence. So this is a kind of tendency can be developed in future standard settings. I'm saying just a little lowering down the threshold of the existence asset or
I'm not sure if we should imply that because, as Peter said, we've left it as a standard by standard decision. So I think the staff are suggesting in this case it makes sense, but I don't think we should necessarily extrapolate.
Yeah, sure, because I'm just learning the implication of conceptual framework of new one. So that's what I'm saying. This is the first kind of a case of applying this new conceptual framework.
Yep.
But there's a change in this in the proposal because, we are changing virtually certain existence from that to maybe it's not fair comparison between this one and the I-37. However, I can feel some kind of a change in their direction.
No, not necessarily. And in fact, the analysis that was done in the provisions research project a couple of years ago, looking at this issue, and obviously it was based on the exposure draft at that stage, not on the final conceptual framework, concluded, and I think rightly, that applying the conceptual framework, it would be open to the board to reach the same conclusions as in ISO 7 or to reach different conclusions. And the framework's not trying to push you in one direction or the other.
Paragraph 35B should not include blah, blah, blah. Is the reverse true? The model will include specific requirements, blah, blah, blah. So can you reverse the text of B? See, what I'm getting at is if you can't reverse the text of B, which I think is what you're saying, because I think you're saying in these scenarios we don't... These scenarios could be important, but we don't have to consider them for all the reasons you explained, right? I think that's what you're saying in B. But I think it also means that really the only criteria we're using is A, existence criteria. Yeah?
Yeah, you're right. So we just have A for the recognition criteria, and as was pointed out, B, we'll need to think about it when we're talking about measurement, but that's after we've decided to recognise.
So that means, to be clear, then an update, because I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
We should remove the words is low and the word high, because I think we're just saying we're not going to address those things.
Yeah.
High.
Okay. Yeah.
Probability or measurement.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sue, what were you saying?
What Anne's saying...
Criteria. Yeah. Yes.
So Anne's point, which is a fair one, is are we really saying, really being asked whether the model should not include specific requirements to address either the probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits or the level of measurement uncertainty. It's not just whether the...
Yeah.
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 Thank you.
Yeah.
Martin?
Only a question, man, after Mary has spoken. And on 28, we say, okay, that we should not have a threshold for probability of inflows and outflows. And in a situation where there is maybe the expectation that the demand will decrease dramatic, then we still then have to recognize this regulatory asset and liabilities, even if we think, okay, the probability of an inflow or outflow is less than 50%, I would not agree with that. And you're saying, okay, that in 28, you said, usually it is very high. But if Mary said, okay, that does not affect any existing thresholds and only measurement, I would think we need something of this kind of threshold for inflows and outflows. Because
For operational reasons?
Yeah, because I would not be happy because when if a company is expecting that the demand will go dramatically down and still want to recognize this kind of assets and liabilities, and that is only be then dealt with in measurement. I don't think that is the right thing. If the probability of an inflow is only 30%, why should they recognize then first 100% and then with measurement doing...
But it doesn't mean that you if you pass the existence threshold, you know, again, remember it's P times Q. And so let's say you've been given the right to raise it by one, and one times expected Q is 100,000. Doesn't mean that you must recognize 100,000. I think that what we've learned about the hybrid schemes and the evolution of this industry, at least right now, is that you may be subject to some demand risk, so you might not get your 100,000. But you're going to get more than zero, you know, from it, and so I think where you measure it between zero and 100,000 is a measurement issue. But I don't think, Martin, you're ever going to have a point when you're going to get zero for that.
But I think Martin's point's slightly different. If I understood it correctly, I thought you were saying that let's choose the second one because I think it's easier. Let's say you've got no idea what Q is going to be; it's just impossible to predict it in the extreme. I think Martin's saying. Would it be, or the probability of the inflow is tiny, would we make people go through the whole process? So he's questioning that.
This is an operational question rather than a...
No, you're saying in 28 it is always high and therefore we should not have this threshold. But I don't agree with it. Why should it be always high, this probability that you get an inflow? Well, can be situations where, I don't know, dramatically changes something and then you... It's not... And therefore, I think I would not be happy that people are recognizing any assets where the probability of an inflow is only 30%. Why should they do that? Because we don't do it in other circumstances.
So let's take that as an example. Let's say it's a 30% probability. So in the measurement, we're going to discuss about how to deal with the estimates of the future cash flows. And I think basically you're going to have two choices. One choice is going to be an expected value approach, which would say it will be 30%. They're taking account of the probability, or the other would be a most likely outcome. And if you went with the most likely outcome, the most likely outcome would be zero. So in that case, it would be measured at zero. And that's for future discussion, which of those you'd go for. So in a way, you'll get a second bite at this question when we look at what to do with the uncertain cash flows.
Can I also say, again, it goes back to tax. These circumstances where there would be an extreme shift in demand in the sorts of environments that we're talking about would be extremely rare. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible that it would happen, but again, the nature of the environment that we're dealing with, we've discussed this many times in the past, the demand is relatively predictable. So, again, I think we just need to caution that, you know, these circumstances, when we're talking about operationality, are likely to be rare when they crop up. I'm not saying that...
That's why the rate orders don't go on for decades. It took a couple of years, and then you readjust the fundamental assumptions to the next rate order.
No, it can't be. Let's assume in Germany with nuclear power, after what happens in Japan, there was immediately a totally different situation. That can happen from day one to day two. It is not over 10 years. It can happen, then demand is totally different. And so I would not My problem is, man, if it is not going to be the right conclusion, if we think if it is real, yeah, maybe, but if it happens, it can be a huge impact. And why should we then recognize any assets which, for which the inflow probability is only, I don't know.
I think in that case, Martin...
Because usually we don't do it also for other assets.
Yeah. I think that brings into, that scenario brings into question the existence. And is
no,
the
existence, you still have the agreement. That is my understanding. That is what Mary said.
I think if you're withdrawing the nuclear supply, I think that is a change in the
agreement. That's a change in the agreement.
Can I ask a question of clarification, though? Because Mary sort of summed up what we were talking about in a way that I thought I agreed with, but I want to check the staff agreed with, which is I think what Mary was focusing on is that the existence question is P a thing?
Yeah.
And it's not a Q question.
No.
But now these questions are really about if there's a low level of certainty about Q, or if either you think there's a low probability of there being Q, or it's very uncertain how much Q is, are we still okay with not having some sort of test that's based on the Q bit of the equation? But you then just responded, I think, slightly differently to that, because are you saying that the existence question is a combination of P and Q, or is it just P? Because I think it's quite different.
I would say it is a question of P, because we're talking about the rate regulation. The Q is important, but the Q, I don't think, is the existence of it. It affects the measurement of what we're going to recognise.
So that means that Martin's questions are valid ones in the sense that you could be comfortable that you're pretty confident what the P is, but you could have quite a bit of uncertainty about, in theory, about what the Q is. Okay. Tom, I'm not sure what order of the card.
I think we should be very careful on this point. Because I think that to have an asset, I think one of the things I've assumed, I think even what Jane said, I think there's a presumption of a reasonably predictable demand inherent in all this stuff. So if we were in a world where the regulator said, you get to charge 12, in fact, I'll make it really quick, you're going to charge 12. No higher, no lower, that's it. You can't even move it. If demand evaporates, you still charge them 12. Really kind of silly world. If somehow we thought that when the regulator said that, demand would evaporate, we would not be creating an asset. I'm creating a ridiculous circumstance. But I think the presumption that it's reasonably predictable is implicit. And I think we'd make a mistake if we define it purely in terms of the price. The ability to have the transfer of resources and based on the obligation presumes a certain level of a minimum level of demand and same on the asset side. So I just think we should be really clear when we write it up. And I was also listening. I found both Daryl and Mary's comments quite compelling, but in both cases, for sure, I think recognition probably should be separated from derecognition and separated from impairment, because I think there's quite a complication in this price and the quantity, and I think we should be very precise when we're talking about which uncertainty we're referring to and then how they combine in the asset or liability or the measurement uncertainty. But I think it's really good to be really, if we're talking purely about price, we should be very clear that we're talking about the uncertainty in the price. And my understanding, even with some regulators, will help you take care of demand. So I think some regulatory agreements within a bound, again, you still need reasonable demand, but if demand isn't quite there in the first year that you're expecting, they'll say, and you can carry your price increase over at something into a second year. So both variables are responding in some regulatory agreements as well, which I think, again, would argue for at least paying attention to both when we write all this up.
And I think that goes back to Jing Chao's point earlier about the time period and, you know, when setting the price and the time that it takes because you're then thinking if I do it in a very short period of time, the price goes up a lot, which could affect the demand. So in that case, they think about then spreading it further over a longer time period, so there isn't the impact on demand. So yeah, it's all interconnected.
Yeah, and your confidence in the reasonable amount of demand on average should diminish with the length of the regulatory interval.
So you're saying existence, in your view, shouldn't just be focused on P, it should also be considering Q?
I'm really concerned that if we do, I think we should just take a real, make sure we have this part right. My inclination is what you just said, but I could be convinced, but I'm nervous about making it purely price.
Okay. Jing Chou?
Thank you. Just a quick come back to Tak and Martin's comments. I think there's slight difference. The case, I think, happened. In reality, we need to address this issue. But I agree that that is a measurement issue. Mm. At the first day, the enforcement rights and obligation is there. Mm. And while the government introduced competition, it's right. I think it's right when sometimes several water plants in one city, and if you performance or manage it not well, it's your fault. So the loss you have to recognize have lost. So I think it's usual for subsequent impairment, loss, recognize something like that. And the Martin point, I think, as I understand correctly, you made a case about the nuclear station, maybe there is a disaster or something like that. But it happens not under control of your entity. It's other things. So in this case, normally, the government or regulator will not use rate adjustment mechanism. Normally, the government will provide a government grant or something else to compensate the loss happened. So I think that's a different cases. We come back to the recognition. I think, as I said, that once we have enforcement rights and obligation, in case the probability will be higher. So I think when we make a judgment in practice, maybe how to assess the probability is very important. So I think paragraph 21 is very important. The stuff, you know, with the four cases, four things, four phenomena. First one is based on the legislation and regulation, no problem. But the B, C, D, based on just what we made the decision with regard to the scope, those rights and obligation arising from timing differences should be enforceable and specific. But here, B is based on your entity's past experience. C is based on other entities' experience. D is advice from legal and experienced advisors. I'm a little bit I'm concerned whether B, C, D can meet the scope, those rights and obligation based on the past experience, other entities' experience, or advice from other side, other people's, enforceable or not, the probability. I'm thinking whether it's consistent with the score just I decide, yeah.
But weren't you getting there more, Jane, sort of if the agreement says reasonable costs or something, words like that, getting your head around what you think the reasonable costs are? So you've decided you've got an enforceable regime, but you need to sort of get comfortable with the establishment of the inputs for the P calculation.
Yeah.
That's more what you're getting at with B through D.
Yeah, I think so. We're assuming that the legislation is clear enough. We're in the scope already, and now we're in the individual timing differences, which is our unit of account that we agreed to last month.
So more granular stuff.
Yes, I think, more granular. So I think should keep consistent when we draft in next, compared so-called enforceable right and obligation, and try to make it more clear. Yeah, they cannot simply based on this judgment. And
Amaro. Thanks, Ness. Well, thank you for the paper. I think it's very good, and I agree with the paper entirely. The discussion, my perception, is actually derived from recognition to measurement very quickly. What we discussed as rights and obligations previous month, and we accepted under the new conceptual framework, they are assets and liabilities. Either P, they have the right to change the price according to the regulatory regime. Agree with Jin Tao, the questions around 28 or TACA, they are in the measurement issue, so will be the next set of papers. But then I read this paper and I read the conceptual framework. I see we are applying exactly the flow of the conceptual framework for recognition. We are only talking about recognition. If this recognition will be zero or will be 100, it's the next phase, is the measurement phase. So I guess it was a very good discussion, in particular for us to anticipate a little bit what to expect on when we come to measurement. But I think on the recognition, I have no additional comment. I agree with staff.
Errol.
So I quite like the articulation of it as a P times Q type of issue. I suspect there may be circumstances in which P might be on a sliding scale, but I think it's a nice, easy way of characterizing it. I am still very supportive of the idea that recognition is dependent entirely on the P part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And in part, the reason for that is I think if once we get into the Q side of things, I think probability is driven by two different things. Mm-hmm. So if I say that at the Q level, there's a probability of 25% of me receiving the money, that either means that in one of four scenarios, I receive the money, and in three or four scenarios, I receive nothing, or it means that I am expecting to receive 25% of the total. So I expect, and that may be the case of a declining quantity over time. Now, the difficulty is, in both circumstances, if I apply measurement, I guess I get to 25% of the total. That seems to give me a very good representation in one circumstance and a risk understanding of the outcome in the other circumstance. And I think I'd rather have it in both circumstances on, not trying to distinguish between the two circumstances, have the 25 on and explain what the risks are around that. In modern scenario on the nuclear thing, I think it probably highlighted something slightly different for me, which is that if I understand what happened in Germany with nuclear supplies, there was high certainty or high probability before the event, and therefore we would have said we want to recognize it immediately after the event. There's very low probability. And it just means that measurement is a big issue, but remeasurement is equally a big issue. And I think that plays around a lot in the probability of Q space.
Martin, you were mentioned.
Yeah. I totally agree that OKZ is purely applying the new conceptual framework. But my understanding in the conceptual framework, we said that we will not recognize then any kind of assets. We will consider if the inflows and outflows have low probability, we will consider that. Because if we follow this discussion also then with, let's assume, IRS 37, then we will recognize any kind of liability, and low probability is measurement. That is not my understanding of the conceptual framework. Only to say that, because still we think, okay, we, at least what my recollection was, we will discuss, is there a recognition low probability threshold?
Okay, so Martin didn't mention my name. He did mention the conceptual framework.
I like your name.
and Martin summarised it correctly, which is, the framework doesn't say don't recognize it if it's a low probability. It says think about whether you should recognize it.
That is what I have done.
And this is what we've asked you to do at this meeting, and I think where you're landing up is that you're not going to say don't recognize in case of low probability is my forecast of how the vote is going to go. I think we do need to clean up the wording, actually, as Aaron suggested, because I think the wording's not quite clear at the moment. I think what we're intending to say is we're not going to put something in the standard that says don't recognise if it's a low probability or don't recognise if there's high measurement uncertainty. We're just not going to discuss that in the standard is what we intend, I think.
Yeah.
And the wording will need to be tweaked a bit to make that a bit clearer.
But Sorry, I'm now getting very confused. But probably because I misunderstand. But we are talking about more likely than not, yeah?
Yeah, for existence.
For existence,
yeah. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Not the probability of inflows or the measurement.
But if the probability of inflow is very low, how can it then be more likely than not that it...
You've got the right to a price, a regulated rate, but the quantity of maybe have questions around it.
Think about something very different, like a way out of the money option. You know, move away from rate regulated from it. There's no question you have the option.
Yeah.
You know, the existence is certain, but if it's way out of the money, there could be a very low probability of inflow. And we're just...
Let's look at the existence question.
This is too sophisticated for me, I'm afraid.
Françoise? It may well be too sophisticated for me as well, because in fact the discussion around P times Q has unsettled my understanding, so sorry if I'm stating something that is the obvious. In my understanding, you may have rate regulation agreements that will lead to having the rate setting adjustments react and create a right or liability solely based on the quantity. And the way the quantities play a role in these rate-setting mechanisms, to me, are quantities from the past. In fact, they characterize the past events, and so they are known. So the circumstance in which...
Exactly my thoughts.
The circumstance in which you... When we say, well, we're discussing only P, that unsettles my understanding because, to me, yes, the rate adjustment is going to reflect in the price, but it may reflect only the quantity that was forecast not having been met. Or is that
what? I think when we're talking about Q, we are talking about two different things. So there's the Q, which is the past Q, which is creating the timing difference. Mm-hmm. And then there's a second Q, which is the Q that we need in order to recover the asset that we've got.
So the P we were talking about, I think, was the future P.
Is the future P.
So that doesn't have any bearing.
The asset that you acquire is based on an estimation of a future P times Q. Yeah. And if you don't make the Q in one period, then you probably get an extension.
It depends.
Yeah, but I think Francoise's point is that the creation of the asset...
It's
related to Q in the past,
yes.
Whereas the recovery of the asset is related to Q in the future.
Yeah. That helped us all.
Yes. That helps me. Yeah. Thank you.
But I still don't understand how you can if you decide it's more likely than not that I'm going to that I have an asset. How you can then still, in the measurement, can have a low probability of...
Mary wants to try. Use a rate reg number. Don't use an option.
No. Hans, I think we're failing to step back and identify the context in which we're having this discussion. The context in which we're having this discussion is writing a standard for rate-regulated activities. I think the language in paragraph 28 that says there's never, it's really rare that there's any, high level of measurement uncertainty or low probability of cash flows is too sweeping, given what we heard in the original outreach about the development of hybrid plans that may put some risk on the entity, back on the entity, about recovery of these items. Yeah. So I think it's too sweeping. But I think overall what we know and what we should say, and this goes back to how we articulate that the replacement of paragraph 35B, is that in light of what we've learned about characteristics of the industry and the circumstances we're talking about, the instances of there being very low probability of inflow or outflow or frequent conditions of high measurement certainty are sufficiently rare that we're not going to specify, conditions as part of the recognition criteria. although this is something that we realize will have to be addressed. You know, we're saying that it's sufficiently infrequent that we don't think it raises questions, but the discussion and Anne's challenge to the language of 35B has raised that I think we have to express it very differently than we drafted, because that's an assumption on our part based on what we've heard so far. And so maybe that's something we have to validate in any consultation, that we think it is not necessary to have criteria. Understand.
So it is so rare that we don't even want to think about it.
Sufficiently infrequent. Sufficiently infrequent, yeah.
Well, otherwise we wouldn't be making the standard.
Right. Yeah.
That's why. Okay. So on
this, I'm with many Martins that concern. So I think, you know, we need to put these two threshold criteria for the recognition criteria, the low probability of influence and the high major uncertainty for safety. But it's very rare that happens. But your purpose is just to. We leave some entities not to reassess kind of the probability of inflow or measurement of whether it's a high reliable or not. But for safety, maybe if something happens, still we do not control any uncertainty of the queue, so some kind of uncertainty. So I think, you know, maybe to be more consistent with the new conceptual framework, for safety, put them all these recognition criteria in the conceptual framework.
We'll try and vote on it with your articulation, Mary. So, do you mind if I'll give it a go, right? So we recommend that the model requires the recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities, but it's more likely than not that they exist, and that we don't include specific requirements for entities to assess recognition based on the probability of inflows or outflows of economic benefits or due to conditions of measurement uncertainty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as background, we can give your reasoning.
Mm-hmm. I think it's... Can I just clarify that? Because I think the part of the wording that's not clear is actually where we said don't include requirements to assess. I think what we really meant is don't include any thresholds that block recognition.
Yeah. So can I add stuff to summarize, including the nuances, the decisions that we have landed today?
Yeah, for the scope paper, I think the board agreed with the recommendation of the staff with the features that we have identified for being necessary and sufficient. However, the board also recommended some improvements for the drafting of that scope. And then for recognition, what we have said is that we recommend the model requires the recognition of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities if it is more likely than not that they exist. And
do not include a threshold.
Do not include a threshold for assessing whether there is a probability of an inflow or outflows occurring or conditions of measurement uncertainty.
I think it's a threshold that would prevent recognition.
Mm-hmm. Specifically mentioning this does open the door for a lot of misunderstanding, clearly.
But that's what the new framework tells us to think about.
Oh, okay. Thanks to the new conceptual framework. Okay.